sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Phyllis Chesler, feminist, activist, psychologist, professor, and author of the fascinating new book, Requiem for a Female Serial Killer. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. As the returns from the recent American presidential election are being certified around the states of our nation, it becomes clear that President Trump has no immediate plans to concede the election he has clearly lost. There are many reasons, perhaps, for this, including political and economic goals unrelated to the results of the actual election, but it also may come down to something rather basic, an inability to ever say that you have failed. I was thinking more generally about the tendency of people not to admit difficult things. It's not surprising, really, when you think about it. I mean, it's always much easier to celebrate triumphs than it is to concede losses. If we can find reasons, well, excuses, it's not really over, the bad guys cheated, it was a conspiracy, the umpire blew the call, the dog ate my homework, it eases the pain of the defeat. And if we can find embers of victory in the ashes of defeat, it was a moral victory, we gave it everything we had, we won a lot of battles even if we lost the war, everybody was against us and we still managed almost to pull it out, we feel better about ourselves and the effort we gave. It struck me that this is far from the first time that someone has been unwilling, perhaps unable, to admit failure. Often that sort of obstinacy, the inability to admit loss, is viewed as strength or even resilience. You know, the idea that if at first you don't succeed, try again, and that the seeds of triumph are often planted in the manure of failure. But in order for that to be true, one first must acknowledge the original loss, accept failure in order to rise from it and succeed. That is, it's okay to lose. Everybody does it. But if you hope to overcome it and rise again, that depends largely on your ability to accept loss, to make changes, and move onward and then upward. In the Torah, our ancestor Jacob had to flee from his home in Canaan with nothing but the clothes on his back, and was tricked by his future father-in-law Laban into serving essentially as an indentured servant for 14 years, and then fled yet again before becoming a successful man and a major patriarch. Joseph, the favored child with the fancy coat, ends up sold into slavery and then dumped in a prison and forgotten, all before rising to become the most powerful man in the world. There are many examples of this in our collective Jewish history, too. I have a T-shirt and gave one to my dad, made by a recent past guest of 2 Jewish, Rabbi Ken Spiro, who is an author and guide on Jewish history. It reads, "Civilizations, nations, and empires that tried to destroy the Jewish people," and then lists ancient Egypt, the Philistines, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persian Empire, the Greeks, the Roman Empire, the Byzantines, the Crusaders, the Spanish Empire, Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union, and shows the status of each as gone. It then says, "The Jewish people, the smallest of nations, but with a friend in the highest of places. So be nice." Well, all that's true, of course, but what was so crucial to the Jewish ability to survive disaster and find new ways to live and thrive came because we were able to admit and accept defeat and yet seek new ways of being and evolving. It is, in many ways, the central aspect of the Jewish story in history. Defeat damaged us, but it never defined us. We were able to rise from it to achieve new heights. There is a great lesson there for each of us personally, too. We all experience loss, even disastrous loss, in our lives. It is our ability to admit defeat, learn from it, and rise from those defeats and seek to affirm the best within us, to achieve greater heights than we did originally, that can really define us. Pretending that defeat is victory is neither growing nor evolving, but accepting loss and choosing to move beyond it to a new, better place is. And it's very Jewish, too. May we all find ways of doing just that in our own lives in this time of substantial loss. To play us in this morning, here's Benny Elbaz and his son, Israeli megastar Gad Elbaz, when he was young, singing Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, If I Forget You, Jerusalem. Benny and Gad Elbaz singing Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, If I Forget You, Jerusalem. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Phyllis Chesler, prominent feminist, activist, psychotherapist, who is also the author of a fascinating new book, Requiem for a Female Serial Killer, will join us. Find out about her relationship with the famous serial killer Aileen Wuornos when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Dinah Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, in our own building, not in the mall. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. During the coronavirus tsoras, a small group can join in person Friday night or Saturday morning by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or join us Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. with full music. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is BEITSIMCHA Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We have our services and classes in blended form, a few people live and the rest online. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access them by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or emailing me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school and many of our classes and services are available in blended formats as well, some live, some on Zoom. Synagogues, again, at 2270 West Dinah Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, or our services in blended format or live on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing synagogue and newest Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning. Phyllis Chesler is one of the most prominent feminist authors, activists, and teachers, a psychotherapist whose new book is called Requiem for a Female Serial Killer, a true crime kind of psychological study, I would call it. How would you term your book? What's the best way to describe it?
It's a psychological thriller with a feminist profiling of a very unique female serial killer and a strong understanding of prostitution and how it is truly the most extreme form of violence against women. That's rape and prostitution and the death penalty. And there are many issues that drew me to this case in Florida.
Now, it's a famous case, most prominently because it was made into a very successful commercial film, Her Story. How accurate do you think the movie was to the reality of Eileen Wuornos?
Well, it was somewhat accurate, and Charlize Theron is a great actress, and she did a brilliant impersonation of her body language. However, the relationship with Tyria, played by Christina Ricci, was nothing like the real Tyria, possibly for legal reasons. And yes, her awful childhood was glancingly covered, but her childhood, like the childhoods of so many girls and women who get tracked into prostituted lives, was horrendous and far worse than those of male serial killers or of other female serial killers. And the film was fiction and could not possibly capture it all.
You know, reading about her early life and the early life of the other women who are prostitutes in the book is horrifying. I don't know how else to describe it. Overwhelmingly horrifying. You know, to dig into that must be challenging, no?
Well, it was the darkest, most sobering reading that I've done yet, but I was also reading about male serial killers at the same time who prey upon mainly prostituted girls and women. So between the two trolling the dark side, it humbled me because how little our society and societies have done to grapple with this monstrous human rights atrocity.
We will explore Requiem for a Female Serial Killer much more with Phyllis Chesler when we return here on Too Jewish in a moment. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, with 100,000 downloads. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, I think your favorite country in the world really is France, but that may be an overstatement. Still, it's a fascinating place and a fascinating Jewish community that goes back really a long way. Can you give us a little bit of an overview since we can't all go to Paris right now?
Very happily. And I will say that I was posted to France as a U.S. diplomat twice, actually. I had the good fortune. First posting only lasted about 5 months, and I was direct transferred to Belgrade, always a hazard when you're in the Foreign Service. But the next posting lasted almost 5 years. And the second posting in particular caused me to crisscross France and travel all over it in the pursuit of my professional duty. So I will not be speaking exclusively or even largely about the Jewish community of Paris, but really about the Jewish community of France. However, just before I do that, I want to put in a shameless personal plug, which
is
your listeners have often indicated to you and to me that they would like more in-depth coverage of the Jewish community of a certain place, be it Thessaloniki or Paris or whatever. So you know that, and many of your listeners know too, that I lead Jewish heritage tours normally overseas. But in this pandemic period, nobody's traveling anywhere, and all my tours were canceled. So I started giving virtual tours in a series of podcasts called Around the Jewish World with Tom Price. And if any of your readers would be interested in podcasts that last between 15 and 20 minutes, they can find it on tomprice.podbean.com.
tomprice.podbean.com.
Right. And Tom Price is one word, all lowercase. Podbean is also one word, all lowercase, and it's P-O-D-B-E-A-N. So, that having been said, let's go back to something I've said many times on your show in reference to countless Jewish communities, which is at the peak of the Roman Empire, when the Mediterranean was accurately referred to as a Roman lake, there were Jewish communities, in some cases very important Jewish communities, in virtually every Mediterranean port city. So whether you were talking about Spain or Morocco or Tunisia or Egypt or Turkey or Greece or what eventually became Italy, the south coast of France, whatever, there were Jews in Roman times in every sizable trading port. And they did a variety of things. Often they were ship's chandlers, suppliers of necessary things. But they also repaired sails, they did craftsmanship, they did all kinds of things. But many of those Jewish communities go back at least 2,000 years. And that is true also in southern France, where actually some of the big cities like Marseille were originally founded by the Greeks, so even older. But when the Greeks controlled much of the Mediterranean, the Jews had not yet spread as widely as they did because, you know, there was the first diaspora after the destruction of the first temple, obviously.
Right. Yep.
And then there was the second one, which, okay, so the temple was destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era, but Jews were actually expelled from Jerusalem and the whole Roman province of Judea in the second century of the Common Era.
137 or so.
So basically since then, there have been Jews in all these places. Now, France has a lot of coastal towns on the Mediterranean. In fact, that's one of the most pleasant areas in France. But interestingly, some of the oldest synagogues and oldest cemeteries are found further inland. And we can get into detail about that next week if you'd like.
Thanks, Tom. We will do so.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe works in a haberdashery, a men's clothing store. One day, his boss comes back from lunch and notices Moshe's hand is bandaged. Moshe says he has good news to report. I finally sold that ridiculous suit we've had in stock for such a long time. You mean that bright orange and blue double-breasted thing, says his boss? That's the one, says Moshe. Mazel tov, the boss says. I thought we'd never get rid of it. It was the ugliest suit we've ever had. But tell me, Moshe, why is your hand bandaged? Moshe replies, well, as soon as I sold the suit to the gentleman, his guide dog bit me. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Careful of those guide dogs. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Toldot includes the treachery of Jacob and the foolishness of Esau, the famous story of brotherly rivalry that sets in motion this central tale of Genesis. It's a story of twins who are anything but fraternal in their interactions. Jacob's a lover of tents, a homebody whose mother loves him. Esau, a hunter, an outdoorsman, a man active in the extreme and more or less devoid of thought. In our weekly portion, Jacob fools his family twice. First, he cons the hungry Esau into selling his birthright, his inheritance, for a bowl of lentil porridge. And then, at the instigation of his mother Rebekah, Jacob fools his father Isaac into giving him the principal blessing, the spiritual heritage of the leadership of the people who will someday be known as Israel. Why is it that Jacob is the one who will become the true father of our people? He's clever and verbal, cerebral, but he lacks basic moral qualities that we should find critical. But Esau, too, is no bargain. All physical exertion and emotional outburst, instinctive but unreflective, all id to Jacob's superego. In fact, it's through both of them that the great story of God's oneness will be carried forward. Both of them, for all their flaws, God finds a way to work for the future and destiny through the two. The message is complicated but useful. The truth is, we are all both Jacob and Esau, partly thoughtful, partly instinctive. We, each of us, are also twins in this sense. We can act with deliberation and care, or forcefully and without judgment. And we all have the capacity to be either ethical or unethical. In that dichotomy lies our innate humanity. And in the persons of Esau and Jacob, we can see ourselves and learn that it is only through God's providence that we will truly find our own promised land. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest, Phyllis Chesler, will explain how her new book, Requiem for a Female Serial Killer, connects to the Torah and what prompted her to write it now. Find out when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, an important and widely heard voice on religion in the modern world, died last week in London of cancer. He was just 72 years old. Rabbi Sacks, who wrote extensively, became highly influential through BBC broadcasts and TED Talks and made frequent media appearances. He withdrew from public life in mid-October after he announced he was being treated for cancer. Sachs was an immensely prolific author, addressing pressing social and political issues in a succession of well-received and best-selling books. His popular commentary on the prayer book, published by Koren, helped to dethrone the traditionalist Art Scrolls Siddur as the preeminent prayer book in American modern Orthodox synagogues. While his religious home was Orthodox Judaism, Rabbi Sachs was one of the most inclusive voices in Judaism. In a 2013 study of his work, Universalizing Particularity, the editors wrote, "Sachs possesses a rare ability to hold in delicate balance the universal demands of the modern multicultural world with a particularism associated with Judaism."
What do we worship? I think future anthropologists will take a look at the books we read on self-help, self-realization, self-esteem. They'll look at the way we talk about morality as being true to oneself, the way we talk about politics as a matter of individual rights, and they'll look at this wonderful new religious ritual we have created. You know the one? Called the selfie. And I think they'll conclude that what we worship in our time is the self, the me, the I. And this is great. It's liberating, it's empowering, it's wonderful. But don't forget that biologically we're social animals. We spent most of our evolutionary history in small groups. We need those face-to-face interactions where we learn the choreography of altruism and where we create those spiritual goods like friendship and trust and loyalty and love that redeem our solitude. When we have too much of the I and too little of the we can find ourselves vulnerable, fearful, and alone.
Sachs's universalism sometimes got him in hot water with more traditionalist elements of the Jewish community. When he was chief rabbi, he published The Dignity of Difference, How to Avoid the Clash of Civilizations, back in 2002, a book whose central message was religious communities have parity in our attempts to find God. God has spoken to mankind in many languages, he wrote, through Judaism to Jews, Christianity to Christians, Islam to Muslims. No one creed has a monopoly on spiritual truth. No one civilization encompasses all the spiritual, ethical, and artistic expressions of mankind. He added, God is greater than religion. He is only partially comprehended by any faith. Some in the Orthodox world accused him of heresy. Judaism, they said, is the ultimate truth. Rabbi Sachs later walked back some of his statements, subtly revising them in later editions. He served as the chief rabbi of Great Britain from 1991 to 2013. His official title was Chief Rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations of the Commonwealth, a title that made him the head of a large network of Orthodox congregations, but not of liberal and ultra-Orthodox congregations. Still, the title has always been one of the most prominent Jewish positions in all of Europe, and he used that pulpit effectively during and after his time as chief rabbi, speaking out against anti-Semitism and in favor of the State of Israel. Queen Elizabeth II received the Hanukkah menorah from Rabbi Sachs at St. James Palace in 2006, marking the 350th anniversary of the reestablishment of the Jewish community in Great Britain. The Queen knighted him in 2005. He was made a life peer in the House of Lords in 2009. Sachs maintained a close relationship with former Prime Minister Tony Blair, who said that the rabbi had the rarest of gifts, expressing complex ideas in the simplest of terms. He called him a man of huge intellectual stature, but with the warmest human spirit. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs was a leader in interfaith relations as well. He was close to the former Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey. Their shared interests went beyond religion. They had a mutual passion for the Arsenal Soccer Club, and occasionally went to games together. That must have been something to see. Jonathan Sachs was born in 1948. His father was a textile trader. His mother drove ambulances in London during the Blitz. Unlike many other future rabbis, he did not attend Jewish schools as a kid, but was educated in Anglican schools. He studied philosophy at Cambridge. In a 2011 essay titled Finding God, he wrote that he had been drawn both to the universalism of philosophy and the particularity of his own Judaism. During his studies, he wrote, the words religion and philosophy went together like cricket and thunderstorms. You found them together, but the latter generally put an end to the former. Philosophers were atheists, or at least agnostics, not he. In the mid-1960s, at age 19, he embarked on what he called a greyhound tour of North America, looking for academic and spiritual direction. Two encounters for Jonathan Sacks in particular were life-changing. He met with Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, the preeminent rabbinic scholar at Yeshiva University in New York, and with Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, head of Lubavitch Movement in Brooklyn. Rabbi Soloveitchik challenged me to think, Rabbi Sacks wrote. Rabbi Schneerson challenged me to lead. He decided to devote his life to Jewish study and leadership. He was ordained in 1976, later completing his PhD in philosophy at the University of London. He went on to lead several prominent London synagogues, one in Golders Green and then Marble Arch in central London, before being named chief rabbi in 1991. Sacks wrote more than 25 books, and the themes became more universal as time went on. His last book, published just this year, is Morality: Restoring the Common Good in Divided Times. His TED Talk in 2017, I played a bit of it earlier, Facing the Future Without Fear, has had nearly 2 million views. In 1991, shortly before he became chief rabbi, Rabbi Sacks appeared on a popular BBC program called Desert Island Discs. Celebrities are asked to imagine what they'd take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. The host uses those items to shape a discussion about the guest's life, career, and passions. Rabbi Sacks said he would take a Talmud, the Jewish library of law and lore, and a pencil so he could write commentaries on it. For music, he wanted to take a devotional song from the Lubavitch tradition called Tzoma Lecha Nafshi, which means My Soul Thirsts for You, God. Quite simply, I hope that someday something like that will be my epitaph, that his soul thirsted for God.
So here is my simple suggestion. It might just change your life, and it might just help to begin to change the world. Do a search and replace operation on the text of your mind. And wherever you encounter the word self, substitute the word other. So instead of self-help, other help. Instead of self-esteem, other esteem. And if you do that, you will begin to feel the power of what for me is one of the most moving sentences in all of religious literature. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. We can face any future without fear, so long as we know we will not face it alone.
There's some good and interesting news this week. I got it from a secret source. The Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Bahrain became the first hotel to offer kosher food in that Gulf Arab state since the new agreement to normalize relations with Israel. Undoubtedly, there's a strong desire to get Israeli tourists to visit Bahrain. And now they can keep kosher in style there when the pandemic calms down. Saeb Erekat, the perpetually optimistic Palestinian peace negotiator who forged close relationships with his Israeli counterparts and pressed until his final days for a two-state outcome to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, died last week. Erekat, 65 years old, died at Hadassah Hospital in Ein Karim, outside of Jerusalem, where he was in the care of Israeli doctors. He had been hospitalized with coronavirus since last month. Erekat received a lung transplant in 2017, heightening his risk of COVID-19 complications. Much of Erekat's adult life was dedicated to multiple attempts to arrive at a peace agreement with Israel with the Palestinians. He was a deputy head of the Palestinian delegation at the 1991 Madrid talks convened by U.S. President George H.W. Bush, the first time Israeli government officials negotiated directly with Palestinian counterparts, albeit in a multilateral setting. Erekat became the chief Palestinian negotiator in the Oslo peace process. It started in 1993 and, with a few absences, stayed in that position throughout his life. He also was Secretary General of the Executive Committee of the PLO. Arakat, a political science PhD educated in the U.S. and England, was known for his erudition, his long memory, and sharp expressions of acerbic anger, which soon softened to conciliation. He announced his resignation as top Palestinian negotiator multiple times, but never actually left the job. He could infuriate Israelis and others, accusing Israel of practicing apartheid, misrepresenting a battle in Jenin during the Second Intifada as a massacre. But Arakat maintained friendships with his Israeli and Jewish interlocutors, earning him well wishes after his hospitalization and their condolences after he died. Saeb dedicated his life to his people, said Tzipi Livni, whose negotiations with Arakat during the 2007-2008 Annapolis talks, when she was the Israeli foreign minister, often devolved into shouting and recrimination. "Reaching peace is my destiny," he used to say, Tzipi Livni said. "Being sick, he texted me, I'm not finished with what I was born to do. My deepest condolences to the Palestinians and to his family." Arakat mourned Yitzhak Rabin very publicly after a Jewish extremist murdered him in 1995. Arakat wept when a reporter informed him that Rabin had been assassinated. In other Middle East news, Secretary of State for the U.S. Mike Pompeo formally notified Congress last week that the U.S. is planning to sell $23.4 billion of arms to the United Arab Emirates, spurring the Senate to call on the State Department to ensure the sale will not diminish Israel's qualitative military edge in the region. The UAE stands to be the only other country in the Middle East besides Israel with certain advanced military technology involved in the sale, including the F-35 stealth fighter jet. The Senate Appropriations Committee included language on the sale in its 2021 spending bill, adding that whatever is sold should not add to vulnerabilities to U.S. military systems and technology vis-a-vis the Russian Federation and China. The arms package had been negotiated in the wake of Israel's recent normalization deal with the UAE. Before the agreement was finished, rumors swirled about a possible sale. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu was opposed to it. Late last month, Netanyahu dropped his objections. Only after signing the agreement, the Americans told us that the Emirates, which always ask for F-35s, is asking permission from us to consider this thing practically. Netanyahu said, "We give our approval to this deal," in late October. Jewish Democrats have opposed the sale. Rabbi Debbie Wasserman Schultz wrote that the F-35 has unique capabilities that should be reserved only for Israel's use. That's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Phyllis Chesler is one of the most prominent feminist authors, activists, longtime psychotherapist and professor, who has written a new book, Requiem for a Female Serial Killer, about the quite famous woman serial killer, female serial killer, Aileen Wuornos, or Wuornos, rather. In looking at this book, which covers sort of her evolution, if you will, and the incredible violence done to her as a child and then as a prostitute, we see something that I think a lot of, you know, Jewish families aren't too familiar with, thank God, just sort of an awful slice of what's going on in America right now. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. Well, it's not just America, it's global.
Sure, and it, you know, it's called the oldest profession for a reason. It's been going on a long time.
It's the oldest oppression, really, not profession.
That's right, yeah.
And people, I wanted the jury in her first trial to understand that prostitutes are routinely, daily, they're being paid to be raped, but often they also get cursed and denigrated, battered, beaten by hundreds of thousands of men in their line of war. It's not work, it's war. They get tortured, they get gang raped, and they get murdered as well. And this is worldwide, and there's such a huge amount of money in it. It's as big as, probably far bigger than, the incomes from running guns and drugs. And it's a crime against humanity. And as I mentioned to you, I once did a Devar Torah on Parshat Vayishlach. And if everyone can remember, the reason that God was grieved initially and decided to bring a mabul, a flood, was because any man, the hotshot men, took any woman they wanted. And so God says, I'm not going to keep wrestling with myself. They're just flesh and blood. That I can't keep doing this eternally. And then we get, a little bit later on, the story of Dinah. And amazingly, what do her brothers Shimon and Levi say, for which they've been castigated? They say, hey, wait a minute, are we going to stand idly by while our sister is treated as a prostitute? By right. which they mean kidnapped, trafficked, tracked, and then held. And they have been criticized for overkill, understand?
Well, they do kill everybody in the town.
Right? Everyone in Shechem. But then there's the argument that all those who stand by during a genocide, so to speak, and who do nothing, who risk nothing, who don't stand against it, who resist nothing, who are opportunistic about it, are in some sense also guilty. So only they break her out, and amazingly, they don't kill her, the defiled victim, which goes on even today in so many cultures.
Right.
And they also don't keep quiet about her rape. The shame does not attach to her, but to Shechem and everyone in that village, was probably not a big place, who allowed their prince to get away with it. So I think that Jews especially need to understand that prostitution is not going to get better for women if it's decriminalized or if it's legalized. And as Lee Warnos herself said, and it's how I begin the book with a quote from her, she says, it's the demand side that's the problem, not the supply side. If men would keep their money in their pockets and their penises in their pants, there would be no prostitution. And the double standards, women have gotten arrested, but not men, not John's. And in Warnos's case, at least three of the men she killed were John's, and because their bodies were naked when discovered by the police, and she did not undress them.
Right.
And two were police officers, like authority figures, and she, who was meant to die a horrible anonymous death, suddenly became a predator, was no longer merely prey, and I believe she killed in self-defense that first time. And that jury didn't even consider that possible because they never got to hear about the nature of prostitution.
You make a point about the fact that when male serial killers are brought to trial, their previous instances of violence are usually suppressed. They're not brought out as evidence because it's too prejudicial. But the opposite is true for female serial killers.
Well, I haven't done a study of that, so I can't say definitively that's true. In this particular case, the first man with whom she was in a struggle for her very life, he had a long criminal record as a sex addict, as a pornography addict, as a whoremonger. But that was not allowed to be brought into the trial because, quote, the dead man is not on trial, end of quote. So what they brought in about Warnos, to some extent, was, you know, her terrible childhood. But then again, she comes from the kind of family that not only would not rescue her, but you're lucky if they don't kill you. And so her uncle brother came to testify against her to reclaim the honor of her grandfather, who was his father. The adoption triangle figures in this long and sordid story as well, as does organic brain syndrome and every kind of post-traumatic stress, which, by the way, does not justify murder.
No, not quite.
But does explain something even as important. Namely, no one helped her. Not in childhood when she lives in abandoned cars in the snows of Michigan.
And does prostitution for a while just to have something to eat. It's a horrible story.
And then is raped and impregnated and forced to give away a child at 14 to be adopted. No one helped her. Social workers, police officers, relatives, they taunted her and they thought that she was either the devil or she deserved this. Or she brought it on herself. And I'm sure she was pretty cantankerous. I'm sure she had a hairline trigger temper even back then. But she was a child.
In exploring this and, you know, you're trying to understand the mind of a serial killer, it's a damaged mind, right?
Well, as I said, yes. But the male serial killers are sadists, sociopaths, show no remorse, etc. In her case, She was very cognitively rigid. She was kind of bright because, I mean, I've had a correspondence with her and we spoke and I met her. She was bright and she drew very beautifully, but she couldn't see very well. She couldn't hear very well. No one, by the way, got her glasses or hearing aids, as in childhood or thereafter. And she may have had a low IQ. When I put all these facts together, I had more compassion for her, even though she was someone who cursed like all her Johns did. She cursed like a sailor all the time. And possibly she was a multiple personality. It's not impossible. She changed voices. But by the time she was captured and then jailed, and she had a very, very quick trial compared to Ted Bundy,
right,
whose jury took much longer, and he killed so many more. I think she was drunk permanently. Most prostituted women have to take drugs and alcohol to endure the killing fields, which is their work, and so she was already always drunk. I wonder, why did Johns want drunken women who are ill and may have fevers, because that's apparently the case on the streets, anyway. And, I would say by the time they executed her, she was quite insane because she'd been on death row for quite a while, 11 years, in isolation. That makes you crazy. It's a form of torture. I don't know what the law is about executing an insane person. And so, yes, had she had a fair trial, perhaps she would have gotten mercy, not merely justice.
What would mercy have looked like? Would it have been life in prison? What would it have been?
Probably life in prison with no parole. And I said to her once, you know, really, you could go for an insanity defense if you choose.
Speaking as a psychotherapist, you could go for an insanity defense.
Yes, but she didn't want that because she was proud. And very often people who have various psychiatric impairments don't believe they do. It's part of their problem. And she wouldn't hear of it. On the other hand, had she done so, they would never have let her out of the mental asylum and they would have doped her up with God knows what forever and ever.
I have a question that kind of emerged from the book, not really about serial killing, but do you think prostitution should be decriminalized? I mean, how does one deal with something that's going to be very difficult, as you said, for men to keep the money in their pocket and their privates in their pants? That's not happened in human history. How do you think society should deal with it, having dug into this so deeply?
Well, every study that I've read so far shows that decriminalizing or legalizing prostitution in no way reduces the violence towards the prostitutes and the diseases that she contracts from Johns, and the danger in which she lives constantly, and it doesn't diminish the rape of women in the general population. So, I'm an abolitionist, and I would like to see women, and this is complicated because it means you have to eradicate poverty globally. And for that matter, war and gang rape, which is intractable. because I think you're right. Men are filled with lust, and as God says, evil thoughts all day, all the time. And it doesn't mean that women aren't also bad characters.
Yeah, I mean, you just wrote about a female serial killer. For all of the explanations and experience that led her in that horrific direction, she does kill people.
Well, I think after the first murder,
which was really self-defense, it doesn't feel like murder in the book at all.
But if she'd gone to the police, would they have believed her?
Yeah.
And she was already a criminal, a prostitute is a criminal by definition. Would it have helped her, by the way, if she was illegally a prostitute? Not really, because society has decided these are beneath contempt scapegoats for male lust who are disposable. They're the ones whose corpses litter the landscape across the country.
Sure.
Not male corpses. Something happened after the first
killing.
And I write about it in the book. Something changed. And I don't want to ruin it for the potential reader.
Right.
Something changed.
One last question. What was the most surprising thing you discovered in writing Requiem for a Female Serial Killer?
I discovered that I was a big fat jerk, because first I thought that she actually could be rescued by having pro bono witnesses testify for that jury, none of whom were called, and I gathered us together. Secondly, I was so intent on exposing the nature of the violence against prostitutes and a woman's right to self-defense, which is more theoretical than real, that it did not occur to me for many years, but wait, she's really a serial killer. I'm hanging out with a serial killer. I'm haunted in the way that Anne Rule ultimately was haunted about her relationship to Ted Bundy.
To Ted Bundy, yeah.
So, and I was humbled because I had grand feminist idealistic visions and came up against what it's like to have a trial in Florida and with such a defendant. The prosecutor, by the way, was Ted Bundy's spiritual advisor, and he's gone on record blaming prostitutes as evil and so on. So I was too idealistic. And I didn't take the measure of who I was defending, although I don't regret having tried to do so.
I want to thank Phyllis Chesler for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Requiem for a Female Serial Killer. And if you pick it up, you won't put it down. I can promise that. Where can people go to find out more about you?
I have a website, phyllis-chesler.com. It's up there on the internet.
I want to thank you, Phyllis, for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi, and Shavuot Tov.
Shavuot Tov to you. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from Chazan Moshe Taube, who passed away last week in his 90s after an exceptional cantorial career as one of the finest congregational cantors in America. Taube was born in Krakow, Poland. As a child, he was one of the Schindler Juden, the Jews saved by Oskar Schindler and his famous list during the Holocaust. He graduated from Juilliard, served a large congregation, conservative one, in Pittsburgh for many years. And we're playing his version of the final Kaddish Shalem, appropriately. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Sandy Tolan, who wrote the excellent book The Lemon Tree, later made into a film, and now has a young adult version of that book just being released. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Amen. Israel.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.